did and formed a cherem, an excommunication against al kol ish v'isha, krovim v'rachokim, near or far, asher yavi et chavereinu v'dinei goyim, will take his fellow Jew to a non-Jewish court, o yachafunu al yidei goyim, or enforce an enactment by the Jewish court, hein sar he'edyot, whether this is going to the prince or to a lower civil court, hein moshel hein sar yod, im lo midat shnehem b'fnei edim kshevim, unless both parties agree. Right. So here, very clear and very explicit, the chaim of Ravenu Tam was that if one of the Jewish parties subpoenas another Jew before a non-Jewish court, and the second Jew does not want to appear before the non-Jewish court, then this is a serious sin that's worthy of excommunication. But the Ravenu Tam says that if both parties agree before witnesses, there's a certification on the part of witnesses that both parties have voluntarily agreed to appear before a non-Jewish court, then this is not, the cherem does not apply. Okay? So
witnesses have to come to a Jewish court.
The witnesses have to come to a Jewish court to certify that both parties have agreed to take, in their case of first instance, their claims before a non-Jewish court. Okay? But this is the reverse. They're going to a non-Jewish court.
Right.
It doesn't say that they're going to court. They just have valid witnesses. There has to be a certification that this was not coerced on both from one party on the other. But as long as we have valid evidence that this appearance between, if Mr. Weinstein takes me to court in front of the Boston Municipal Court, then if I voluntarily agree to appear there, then, and there's evidence to that effect, then no great moral sin has been performed here. The cherem applies to those who are coerced to go before, according to Rabbeinu Tam. This is certainly not the Rama.
What did the Eidim accomplish?
The Eidim accomplish that this was voluntary on both parts. In other words, if later on one of the parties claims that this was an involuntary use of a non-Jewish court, and they want to collect money on the basis of the fact that someone had slandered them or brought them before a non-Jewish authority, then there are witnesses to counter that.
Did that start in the Jewish court?
Then the Adam allowed it to go to the No. The situation is that you're trying to collect some money from me that I owe you, and you take me before the Boston judge. And I agree to go. But since later on I might claim that I never agreed to go, after the Boston judge says that I really have to pay you $25,000, I sort of now say that I was taken before the non-Jewish judge involuntarily, then if there are two witnesses to that effect, then the cherem and the punishments don't apply.
It feels like...
Rabbeinu Tam was in France, and we're talking about the 13th century. Okay?
It feels like we're okay having the non-Jewish court decide the case, but we're looking to avoid a conflict of jurisdiction within the non-Jewish court, almost a political sensitivity to that.
Yeah, the thing is a little bit complicated because, and as I said, I didn't want to get to the cherem of Rabbeinu Tam tonight. That's why I didn't Xerox it. But since Mr. Weinstein brought up this issue, I want to deal with it head on. What I want to deal not so much head on is to, first of all, try to get a picture of what was happening. We need to know two things. Really, we need to know three things. We need to know what the internal structure of the Jewish courts were. We need to know what the structure of the non-Jewish courts were. And we have to know to what extent there was or was not authorization from the non-Jewish authorities to Jewish judicial autonomy. Last time we saw two quite contradictory things. On the one hand, we had seen the enactment of Louis the Pious and of Henry the Fourth giving a substantial amount of Jewish judicial autonomy, even more than was within the Roman enactments. And on the other hand, we have the testimony of the Rambam saying in large portions of France there was no Jewish self-government, and that's why the judges coming from there didn't know a thing about civil law. So obviously, things vary from place to place. Secondly, when we go back to the beginning of this period, which means the time of Charlemagne and Louis and Henry and so on, we're going to see that this these enactments, which seem to be a reversion of Roman law, and then even a strengthening of the Roman granting of autonomy to Jewish citizens, really is something quite different. The way in which it's quite different was that under Roman law, at least, say, from the 4th or 5th century onward, Jews were regarded as citizens of the Roman Empire. The intent of these laws, even though they were worded practically the same, was to clearly state that Jews were aliens, that they had no rights as citizens within the French, within the German monarchies, or any places in the Holy Roman Empire, and so on. So that the nature of these external edicts, which we have to evaluate, they really meant something quite different at the time of Henry IV than they may have meant during the time of Julius Caesar or later Roman emperors that we had read. In contrast to what was happening during the existence of the Roman Empire, and also in contrast to what was happening in Islamic countries, where the Jews were regarded as second-class citizens, dhimmi, but nevertheless citizens, people that should be looked down on, but people who intrinsically had some rights, rights of residence, rights to be there, people of the book, they were despised, but they were citizens. What was happening with these edicts in by granting of local autonomy by the emperors in the Holy Roman Empire and in Germany and in France and so on, was, on the one hand, it's true that they were granting internal Jewish autonomy, but the nature of that autonomy was such that the Jews from that period on no longer felt that they had the right to live, for example, in those countries. They were aliens, they were guests, and in fact they were eventually all kicked out of all of those countries by the end of the 15th century. So we have to be a little...
Germany, mm-hmm. Germany.
Yeah, sure. Okay. But I first want to have a look at what was happening internally. And this is also extraordinarily complicated. And it's, as I mentioned at the beginning of this year, it's extraordinarily complicated because all of the historians that have written on this subject have written on it from the point of view of a vested interest. They were trying to make a point, one point or another, and therefore, I don't claim to be devoid of these vested interests myself, but nevertheless, we have to be very careful in how we treat secondary sources, because they're all written with through the view of one lens or another. So I'm going to now go back and do some things which pose the problem. So again, instead of starting in the 10th century, we will go back to the 10th century and the beginning of the construction of the European communities, which I am emphasizing that these European communities were quite different in their structure from what was happening in the Jewish communities under Islamic control. Let's take a look at my page 9. Here's a letter from Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein, who's one of the leading Talmudic scholars in the 15th century, writing from Vienna, or rather its suburbs.
Which state is that?
This is Trumat HaDeshe. It says on the top. Oh, yeah. My page 9. תיכתב ותשלחתם לשנה טובה ומתוקה, הוביח ומרוחי יוחנן יצאו, וכן כאשר ביקשתני על דברי אותו, רבי דאר הובי, כי לא מילני ליבי להסכים לדבריך אתה. I can't agree with you. ויבוא דמילת התמיר היא בענייני ההמון עם, ואף בלב מורה הרואה בלגון אינש לנשי וקל לרקל לחלוק ושכבר עירה לי כי יוצא בזה על ידי הרים מברונה שנדע גם כן אחד לצורכו ונתיתי לו בהסכמה וכשנגדו ברח והלך לו לבתי דין הרזים ונפק כדי וכתרו מנגד. So obviously this is a case in which one, a rabbi has used his powers of excommunication against someone and is now insisting, is asking for support on this matter from the Truma Sadesh and from Yisrael Isserlein, who is unwilling to give it. The Emet Gam L'Didi Kasheh L'Hargil M'Pnei Kanat Ador. It's difficult for me also to agree because of the circumstances. Mikshash Dayanim M'Kulkalim. Because of my fear of corrupted rabbis. Ki hanismachim rabim, because those who have received degrees are many, aval hayodim huatim, those who are knowledgeable are few. So here you see one of the leading experts, one of the leading rabbis, heads of the yeshiva in the 15th century, complaining that the rabbis of his time, or the so-called Dayanim of the time, who were using the power of excommunication rather freely, he cannot agree to that because there are many of these rabbis who've got official diplomas sitting around, and the scholars amongst them are few. And to understand this, you have to appreciate that normally, in contrast to the Rambam, where Yisrael Isserlein is a mild-mannered person, for him to write this is a pretty startling business. What was this corruption or that was taking place within the rabbinical body in 15th century Germany? Let's take a look at the next Shuvah, which has many startling passages in it. This is from the Marive, also 15th century. I'm letting you know, Shahakahal Bebresel, the community in Breslau, Shalfuli Tzil Miyuchad, have sent me a special messenger. Every complaint that you've brought against the community in Breslau, they've responded to. And furthermore, on the main matters of the case, the community has brought great people to agree with their position. And since this is so, what right do you have to complain against the community in Breslau? They don't want to accept you either as an officer or a judge or a dayan, and they've given good reasons for this. So here, Rabbi Shlomo was trying to secure his position as the rabbi in Breslau, and the community there was firm in their opposition. When I asked you to turn to so-and-so, Rabbi Katz, whoever this, Rabbi Katz, to settle this matter between them, he refused to get involved. He gave good reasons for him not wanting to either adjudicate or arbitrate in your dispute with this community. From the moment that this dispute between the two of you broke out, between the community of Breslau and you trying to be the rabbi of this community broke out, וכתבתי לשני הצדדים, לא גיליתי לשום צד דעתי. I refused to express my own personal opinion to either of these two sides. ואמרתי אל ליבי, I said to myself, Shema me'atzmam nimtza teref et ha'Allah. Perhaps they can come to some agreement by themselves. O ha'aluf maritz yatz levalei tuisim dimahem yimtzu derech sheyasiru sinatam v'kinatam. Or perhaps this rabbi would be able to settle the matter. V'kiviti letov v'leshalom. I had hoped for a peaceful settlement of this dispute. V'ein marpeh. And it just didn't come. V'inei mitoch machloket zeh ha'medina meshubeshet u'muvulbelet. And because of this dispute between you and the townsfolk of Breslau, the whole community is messed up. Ve'ein shalom le'yotzei v'ba. There's no peace to anyone coming in or going out. Ve'ein seder la'hakila. V'yesh le'chush l'kama takalot she'yetzu mitoch machloket zeh. And there are all kinds of problems that can arise from this dispute. V'kevin she'tamid atem sholchim li ratz acharatz. Since you keep sending me one messenger after another, u'mishnei hatzadim atem tzo'akim alai, me'ata k'tzat ha'davar talui bi. By now, to some extent, this matter is in my hands. L'chein et chitzinai hine'arti li'ot naki mi'Hashem u'Yisrael. So therefore, I've girded my loins to be honest before God in Israel. L'taken mashu b'yadi l'taken. And I will tell you my humble opinion. And he who knows the innermost workings knows that someone who is scholarly and able. V'hachi shadar Rav Shriragon, Yochid Mumche, D'Hashiv, K'Rav Nachman, D'Hashiv, K'Rav Nachman, B'Doro, D'Baki, V'Mishne, V'Talmud, V'Baki, Nami, V'Shikul Hadat, U'Ma'inim, V'Dinim, Kama Shani, U'Manasi, L'Rabbanan, Zin, and Sagi, and L'Chosu, B'Leita Uta, K'Gon, Hai, Havi Mumche, L'Rabbi. That is the definition of someone who is an expert for the public. V'ikar lashon mumche menuse. The phrase mumche means someone of experience. Kedetnan yotzin b'mkimiyem mumche, mufarish b'gmora henu de'itmechi kamiyem. Kekach v'inon dayan mumche, shemunusach l'rabim, v'chachmatal gluya ha'mufresenet l'rabim, dan afilu yechidi, v'yachol ladun et adam afilu ba'al kocho ad kan lashon ha'ashir. Someone who has been long experience and expert can adjudicate matters alone. But now in our generation, nitkalkulu hadavot, v'nitma'atu halavavot, v'nitavtu hadayanim. Now, unfortunately, in our generation, the hearts have become smaller, and the judges have become corrupt. Lo ashkachan shum lamdan ba'olam shehu mumche l'rabim shehu yor'u l'kach. There's no one in the world who fits this criterion of Rosh Yiragon, sheyehe nikre mumche l'rabim. וחהי גבנו כתב האגודה בפר כמה לחולים, אחד הקיומה היטב כדו לא שר סכינו לחכם השמתינם לי. Any shochet who doesn't show his knife to a chacham should be removed. וכתב האגודה ויתה בזמן הזה התלמיד חכם המולכים הזה, ועוד שאין תלמיד חכם שיודע אפילו מסכת קלה. Nowadays there's no תלמיד חכם who even knows the simplest possible מסכת. כל שכן, ובזמן הזה שאין אנו נחשבים כנגדן בציפורן שלהם הייתה רחבה מתחילתן. Their fingernail is broader than our belly. ומזה הטעם כתב הרבי מרי מולן, שבזמן הזה אין דנין דין תלמיד חכם על שום למדן המבזה תלמיד חכם לקנות סולטל ותרזה. Therefore today, we don't apply the law that says that some one תלמיד חכם who insults another is obligated to pay a pound of gold. ועוד יותר רעיון שהביא אל צירה ואין כאן מקומו. וכן בכל המקומות שעברתי, in all the places that I passed through, לא ראיתי ולא שמעתי שום למדן, I never found any scholar שהיה דן על שום אדם בעל כוחו, who judged anyone against his will, אף על פי שמקצתם היו גדולי הדור. כמו רב זלמן וונקל, מרי מולן וכאילו. ואפילו בימי המוראים היו מונים עצמם מלדון כדאית בפרק כמד הסנהדרין, רב הונה כדאית הדינה לקמי היום מחניף בעשור הרב, כי עזר לדינה אמר ברוב נעשי לקטל עזר הצפר. מניהי טיימן נראה ששורת הדין נותן Therefore, the rule should be she'ein lecha koach ladun al shum adam bal kocho. You have, do not have the right to judge anybody against his will. U'befrat al kahal Breslau, and certainly not on the community of Breslau. Kevan de lo nichaluhu lekabel da'atcha kasher yadua, because they do not agree to accept you as their rabbi. De lo kavinan da'itan legabecha, their soul is not close to yours. Ve'ein da'atcha noach mihem. And they don't like you, and you don't like them, and therefore you don't have the right to impose yourself on that community as a rabbi. And you should not be insulted by this. The adata, you should know, kama onesh gadol talui b'mad da'in dina k'di ite b'vekav nesanin v'yamu ha'chachamim ha'chashech atzmo manadin parek mimenu eiva v'gezel v'chul. Someone who removes himself from being, from adjudicating cases, removes enmity and theft and so on. But tetali, and you should know, I'm happy to say, shekol yamai lo danti al shum adam bal kocho. I never judged someone against his will. V'tamir ani monea atzmi mi hadin v'chol ma'amatzei kochi. I try to remove myself from ever adjudicating any kinds of cases with all my force. Afilu kisheshnei habalei dinim mitzatzin ladun mepnei v'tzol mir lefanai v'tzol nachshav. Even if two people want to come to me to a judgment, I try to avoid giving, entering into adjudicating a case. Of course, it's the im tishma la'atzati u'ledidi tzaitit. And if you will listen to my advice and pay attention to me, lo teishev etzel hakahal b'shum din. You should not sit in any court with the community. The adata shepiske ba'alei batim upiske lomdim shnei hafachim. The decisions of the courts, which are manned by laymen, and the halacha are two opposites. Okay? V'amru perek ze barer, kach hayu nekiyei hadat Yerushalayim osin, lo hayu yoshvim bedin, ela imken sheyodim mi yeshev imahem, v'na'er letalmid chacham shelo yachnis atzmo v'esek habalabatim, ela yizkeh be'elat ya'alat ahuvim, uvezeh temtze chen v'sechel tov nu'uma katan Yaakov Bey. So
modestly. However, it works the other way, if I can remind you, in certain Latin American countries, where
this is not the civil court.
I'm just saying, what he, Jewish court and
these are Jewish. Let's understand what's going on here. A, he's telling us that the courts in, are not manned by Rabbanim.
The Jewish courts.
Huh? Piskei balabatim. Don't go, don't involve yourself with the Kahal. The Kahal is adjudicating these cases. The Kahal is adjudicating these cases according to Piskei Balabatim.
Which could simply mean Talmudim?
No, what mean? The court, these are cases. Dinim, Al Teshev Vedin.
It says Piskei Balabatim?
Yeah. Psak. B'shum Din, Al Teshev Eitzel HaKahal B'shum Din. Don't sit with the Kahal in any case. Din means a judgment, a case. Because he's saying that the Kahal will adjudicate cases according to the layman's belly opinion,
which is
contrary. No, this is a case.
Where do you see that?
Well, Shum Din.
No, but the Shum Din, he's telling him not to get it.
No. You do not. You should. If you want to take my advice,
don't get involved in Din.
Okay, don't get involved in adjudicating cases.
Right. So he's saying, certainly, don't become the rub in the town where you can adjudicate.
Not only that, he's saying not only shouldn't you get involved and not be the rub in the town, he's saying that you should not sit with the Kahal, with the community, in any case. Because you know, let's just read it. It's black and white. I'm not reading anything here. V'im tishma la'atzati. If you listen to my advice, ulididitzayit, and you pay attention to me, lo teishev heitzel ha'kahal v'shum din. You should not sit with the kahal whenever they're adjudicating any case.
Why?
the adata, because you know, shepiskei balabatim, the decisions that the balabatim, that is the kahal, make in these cases.
It's not necessarily a court.
No, of course it's a court. The decisions that the balabatim are making in this case, upiskei lomdim, and the decisions that a scholar. B'shum din. Let's just read it. Lal teished etzel hakahal b'shum din. Do not sit in judgment. Sit in any case in judgment with the judges of the kahal, because you know shepiskei balabatim, that the decisions that laymen make in a court case. That's what the word psak means here. It doesn't mean that they're paskining a shaila in your daya. They're deciding a case. Don't sit with the kahal in any adjudication, because the conclusions that laymen reach in a court case, upiskei lomdim shnei hafachim, are two opposites.
What is the relationship between that statement and the beginning when he says, they don't want you as a tafsir or a dayan?
That's right. They don't want you there as their rabbi or as their dayan or anything. Furthermore, he's saying, because they didn't like him. There was a role of a community rabbi which he tried to impose himself on this community, because he regarded himself as the great scholar.
What role would he have had?
He would have had, we will have to come to that, he would have the role of being involved in weddings, divorces, and so on.
We don't want him to be a dayan.
That's right.
We
have to understand. So you're raising a very important question. What did the rabbi do in that case? We're coming to a very, very complicated problem here. At this period, which is the end of the period rather than the beginning of the period, because I just want to show where this thing is leading, at this particular point in time, the courts in many of these towns, if not in all of them, were manned by the kahal. Remember, we saw this at the very first shiur when the notable Yehuda was complaining that in Prague, the scholars would only get the crumbs of the cheap cases where there was no profits to be made, but the non-scholarly laymen were manning the courts. All right, now I'm showing that this was also the case in the 15th century. This wasn't a development that only took place in the 18th century. We see here, this is a very important sentence. As Aviva says, this is, to a certain extent, a degree of irresponsibility, and the contrast between the role of the leading scholars in the Ashkenazic communities, such as the Marivei, who tried to withdraw entirely from the notion of being involved with actually adjudicating cases and being a judge, and the situation that was, until the end of the 19th century, present in the Islamic countries, where there were organized Jewish courts always manned by Dayanim, not necessarily the greatest of scholars, but at least professionals.
Okay. What was the point thing the judges here and the layman judges?
The court, the community.
The community was electing a certain
number. The community had a board, and that board elected a certain number of people as its judges, and these were generally deciding cases not according to Talmudic law. That's what the Marivei is saying. If you have any doubts, let's read that sentence again. There's no way of reading this any other way. This is what he's saying. Al teshev etzel hakahal, lo teshev etzel hakahal b'shum din. You should not join the kahal whenever they adjudicate any case. If you want my opinion, the Marivei is writing. The adata, because you know, shepiskei balabatim, because the decisions of this lay court, upiskei lomdim, and the decisions that a scholar, that a Talmud Chacham would come to, shnei hafachim him, they're two opposites. Okay? So the situation, what? No.
I'm going to say yes. But no.
Well, wait, how do you read this any day?
Let me ask you to interpret for me piskei lomdim.
Yeah, piskei lomdim means a decision, the decisions that scholars would come to.
That would be a court of scholars?
Any scholars, the scholars.
Why is Balei Batim, any Balei Batim? Why do you make that a court and the others not?
Balei Batim are not scholars. Just
I know, but what you're saying, Piskei Balei Batim means a court.
Right.
But Piskei Lomdim.
Well, if there would be a court of scholars, but there are no courts of scholars.
So
he's saying.
How could Piskei Balei Batim?
Because the Kahal.
Court?
The Kahal.
Right. I say yes, but I
do not. No, you're right. It doesn't. He's telling this person to avoid
Right. Don't get involved in that anyway, because their decisions, whatever you decide, they would have done differently, and they're not going to like your decisions anyway, and they don't want you, but that's a secondary thing.
But here he's saying above and beyond this. He's saying, I have tried to avoid all my life getting involved and adjudicating any case, even when both sides appeal. And furthermore, he's saying that you should follow my example, because as you know, they don't get involved with the kahal as they're adjudicating cases. And
actually, these are Jewish courts.
Right? Yes, of course, the Jewish courts. Of course, the Jewish courts.
We come back to the case of present-day Israel.
That's the point here.
The courts are Jewish, but they're not rabbinic.
I
want to
address this gentleman.
Dr. Tachman.
Okay, I think what we're making note of here is that there are two possible kinds of constructions of courts. The one that obtained in this time, according to this scholar, which is a non-scholarly court that doesn't, according to this scholar, know anything enough to make adept decisions or even honorable decisions. It says here that there's one kind that's a court of knowledgeable people, mumdim, or scholars, of the learned. But the Baal Batim are not a court of the learned. When they're making
the
decisions.
Courts of mumdim.
That's right. And therefore,
there were no courts of mumdim.
There were
no courts of the decisions. Okay, the decisions. Okay. Let's take a look again. Next Shuvah of the Mashal. All right. Let's take a look near.
But it seems to me, in adjudicating any issue, there is an overriding principle here that goes with dissension. If the two parties agree to come before any court, whether it's the Balbatim or the rabbinic court,
here they have no choice. It's not. There was Jewish internal judicial autonomy. The Jews were administering their own courts. It's just that the Jewish courts administering justice in these communities were not administering Talmudic law, nor were they manned by rabbis. They were not rabbinic courts.
That's very close to modern day Israel.
That's true. Let's take a look at the Mashal, writing a century later, a little bit more than a century later, near the star. It says, "Kafisha yimzul omer hadat kasher hahergil hu la'avod la'avodnetenu shebatla b'avodnetenu rabim din Torah machmat dayanim u'kulkalim." Because the laws of the Torah have been eliminated because of corrupt dayanim, v'rov hamishpatim v'hadinim dahaidna al yidei balabatim ufi svarata. Yes, most judgments.
Most rules are
not rules. Dinim.
Dinim, not dayanim.
Dinim means judgments. Right, rules, the law, judgments. He's talking about two people who came before a lay court, and he's saying that it's accepted. That is valid because, unfortunately, in our day, most adjudication. Rov hamishpatim v'hadinim, most judgments and decisions, d'ha'idna, nowadays, al yidei balabatim lefi svaratam v'omedata. Unfortunately, he's saying exactly the same thing that the Marivei was saying, which is not in as sharp as language. He's saying, lefi the shabbat lab avonoteinu harabim din Torah. Unfortunately, the laws of the Torah have become neglected in our time, have been bitbatla, or have disappeared in our time, machmat dayanim ukulkalim, because of corrupt dayanim.
So you did have dayanim.
Huh?
Corrupt or just spoiled?
Spoiled. I'm using corrupt in the general meaning of the term.
So there were two courts, right? There was Dayanim and then...
No, he's saying there were two courts, right? But most adjudication was taking place in front of the courts of Balabatim. The Fisher Batla Bavanoteno Harabim Din Torah Machmat Dayanim Ukul Kalim Barov HaMishpatim VaHadinim DeHaIdna. Judgments and decisions today are taking place al yidei balabatim lefi svaratam for omed da'atam.
So it's not even an argument for modern day Israel in the sense that it's even more of an indictment. But modern day Israel, at least the judges have a legal tradition, they have legal education, and they're basing themselves on precedent. Here it seems like everybody's doing ish kei yashar be'inah, whatever they feel good. Well, at least that's
the Marshal's opinion. Remember, he's looking at this from the rabbinic point of view, which would regard any system other than the Talmudic system as not having, as being anarchy. You don't necessarily have to accept his assessment of the system, but I'm simply pointing out that by the end of the 15th century, and even later, by the middle of the 16th century in Poland, I want to concentrate on the period from the 9th, 10th century to the 14th, 15th century in Germany. At the end of that period, there was a conflict between rabbis and the community, and that in many communities, the courts were not manned by rabbinical scholars, but were manned by the city council, by the kahal, and the judges were laymen, not talmidei chachamim, and the Maharil goes so far as to advise one of his students, or whatever the relationship between him and this fellow from Shlomo from Breslau was, to stay away from judging altogether, because as you well know, the judgments are made by lay people whose conclusions are opposite to that of Talmudic law.
But we know what body of law the Jewish civil courts were applying.
Well, we're seeing from the Marshal that they were following common sense, adjudicating on the basis, as was resurrected later in the Beit HaMishpat HaElyon. So I want to remind you that this was exactly the situation in Israel 1,000 or 1,200 or 1,300 years earlier, at the very beginning of our discussion. There was a period of time in which there was a conflict between the local courts, remember, and the central courts appointed by the Nasi, and that it was due to the ingenuity and genius of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi that he was able, through a process of absorption, to get the local courts absorbed into the centralized system and therefore impose Torah and Talmudic law on the local court system. It was a process of co-option rather than a process of conflict, and that was an ingenious political resolution. So this is not something that's unheard of in Jewish history.
Yeah. I remember there's a chart that showed things like that. I was very reluctant to go to the Bezlin for that, because this time they know some obscure horse from Mishpat, and the whole case would be done on that specific horse from Mishpat, and that was contrary to any business practice.
Right. We'll come to that also. But at the moment, I'm simply pointing out
that is a Bianco.
That? Right. But exactly. But this is all internal. We're all talking about internal Jewish courts. Here it's not an issue going to a non-Jewish court versus a Jewish court. These are all Jewish courts. I'm simply saying that the statement that throughout all of history until recently, Jewish courts were always enacting laws according to the Talmudic law, and that it was always the Rabbanim who were the heads of the Batei Din, is simply factually not true. It's simply factually not true.
In this era, as far as you're aware, of the 15th century,
there are systems of Jewish foods that Jewish people, men, who were not rabbanim and not interested in Talmudic law, could go and learn, quote unquote, law.
No.
No law school, law system outside of the religion.
No, no. The only systematic law was Talmudic law. That's a partial answer to your question. But the story is much more complicated than that. The reason that this was happening was that the 15th century, which is the end of the period that we're studying, was a period in which the rabbinate itself began to be professionalized. It was a time, it was the beginning of the time, Mr. Weinstein always raises the idea of the fact that the smicha that we have today has nothing to do with the smicha as it existed in Talmudic times, but in fact, the 15th century was the period in which the rabbinate began to be professionalized, and the notion that someone would be a professional rabbi if and only if he got a diploma from a recognized yeshiva, as opposed to the notion that a person could decide a question if his own private teacher had given it him, created a class of professional rabbis who were earning their income from such things as marriage, divorce, and other various things. And at the end of this period, there were sort of three powers in the Jewish community. There were the great scholars. Today we would be calling them the Rosh Yeshiva, people like Rav Yisrael Yesolim, or the Maharikim in Italy, and so on. There were the Jewish community boards, the Kahal, and there were the rabbis. And each of them were fighting with one another to some extent. This rather sharp statement of Rabbi Yisrael Isselin, that there are many people who have diplomas but few who know anything, is a statement having to do with the issuance of diplomas. The notion of talking about musmachim would have been something that was inconceivable a century earlier. Now, the reason that this was happening in the 15th century was because it was the beginning of a rise of professionalism in everything. It was the time that medical schools began to become professionalized, the establishment of universities. All of this was something that was taking place in Europe. So we're seeing some sort of a process that's taking place in the 15th century, but in order to understand it, we have to go back and understand the power of the community. How did that become established? And that was something that took place already in the 10th century. So now, what we will, our time is up for tonight, but if you can, we will go through it in Yetzer Hashem next week. We now have to go back and see what the origins of the Ashkenazic community were, and community self-organization were, and for that we go back to the 10th century, and the Kalonymus family, and so on and so forth, and we will have to just trace that history forward, and at the same time paying attention to what was happening externally, where the Jews became more and more alienated from society as a whole. Their legal rights were taken away, and of course they were the major disasters of the Crusades, which were also, and of course the events that we're talking about here happened after the terrible massacres pursuant to the Black Death. So we have to take all of these pictures into account. Now, schedule. In Yetzer Hashem, there will be a shiur next week, but then there will be a long hiatus until the second semester. I have the month of January. I expect to spend a good chunk of it in New York, and I'm not teaching any classes, so I think that after next week in Yetzer Hashem we will resume. We will have to interrupt our study of the construction of the Ashkenazi communities. As I say, the whole picture of the Ashkenazi communities is completely different from what was happening in the Islamic communities. In the Ashkenazi communities, the power was always local. At a certain juncture, the leaders of the Jewish community were themselves great scholars, and therefore the power of the scholarly class of the Talmidei Chachamim and the heritage that they gave to us was great. But then there became a period of time, especially in the 13th and 14th century, which we'll have to understand this phrase, Niskalkalu HaDayanim, what that means, and how this was connected to the establishment of the universities in Europe, which was taking place in the 15th century, and also the professionalization of all activities, which was taking place.
Yeah.
But after the 15th or the 16th century, to practice medicine, you had to have a medical license.
And next week, we're going to get through the
Yeah, this was something that was taking place. Professionalization, the construction of a professional class, which was tied up with the construction, the establishment of the universities, was a major event that was taking place there. That impacted on the fact that there then was created for the first time a class of, a rabbinical class, a class of people with rabbinical diplomas as distinct from scholars. Rabbis as opposed to Rosh Yeshiva.
Like today, college.
In the letter I